As Aeneas became increasingly comfortable building Carthage with Queen Dido, the god Mercury appears to him. "You, so, now you lay foundation stones for the soaring walls of Carthage, building her gorgeous city, doting on your wife, blind to your own realm, oblivious to your fate." Aeneas is supposed to be headed for Italy and the beginnings of Rome, Carthage's great enemy. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar podcast from Wyoming Catholic College. The last presentation at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought this past June focused on the story of Aeneas and Dido from Virgil's Aeneid, the great founding myth of Rome. Surviving the destruction of Troy by the Greeks, Aeneas, carrying his father and leading his son, escapes by ship. The gods have said that he is to go to Italy and there found a kingdom that will become Rome, the Rome of Augustus Caesar, who commissioned Virgil to write in the first place. Stopping along the way at Carthage, he meets Queen Dido, who is building a great city. They fall in love. He stays. The parallel with Anthony and Cleopatra is obvious and was probably intended. But there is a most important difference. Whereas Anthony stayed in Egypt, forsaking Rome, Aeneas sailed from Carthage for the sake of Rome. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Tiffany Schubert gave us this presentation about the two couples and the relationship of politics and Eros.
In the 14th century poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the anonymous poet begins his story of Arthur's court with the fall of Troy. From the burning ashes of the fallen city, Aeneas and his ancestors spread out across Europe, founding not only Italy, but France and Britain too. In history and in imagination, Rome is the central city and civilization, the nourishing mother of medieval Christendom, as well as of Shakespeare's England. And in fact, King James, successor to Queen Elizabeth, crafted a public image of himself as Caesar and his imperial project as a reincarnation of the Roman imperial project. So Shakespeare and his time very much thinking of themselves as the inheritors of Rome. So, here at the end of our time together, as we have wrestled with Shakespeare's circuitous and torturous reflections on Roman identity, we're going to turn to Rome's origin myth, right? The story of how Rome, imperial Rome, perhaps more so, than republican Rome, how it came to be. And we're going to look at one of the most poignant and costly sacrifices demanded by that project, the death of Dido. Dido is a victim of Rome, of empire, of the fate that Jove has determined for Aeneas. She is the queen of Carthage, splendidly beautiful, newly arrived from Tyre after her brother Pygmalion killed her husband Sichaeus for his great wealth. When Aeneas first appears on her shores, Dido is building a new city, a magnificent woman, beloved by her people, in charge, having dealt with encroaching threats from without. By the time he leaves, she is lying on what she calls their marriage bed on top of a pyre, having stabbed herself in the chest. The tension that we see in Antony and Cleopatra between duty and desire, between Octavia and Cleopatra, is part of Rome's founding myth. Dido and Aeneas are indispensable lovers in the grand Western tradition of Eros gone awry. Indeed, Antony imagines that in the underworld, he and Cleopatra will be more admired than Dido and Aeneas. He says, "Where souls do couch on flowers, we'll hand in hand and with our sprightly port make the ghosts gaze. Dido and her Aeneas shall want troops and all the haunt be ours." Love this image of them sort of wandering through the flowers, holding hands. Absolutely, absolutely lovely, absolutely Shakespearean and not at all Virgilian. Right. The souls in the underworld, right, are so taken with the sight of Antony and Cleopatra, right, walking through the flowers hand in hand, that they will turn away from Aeneas and Dido, the archetype of doomed Roman lovers. Antony and Cleopatra will surpass their romantic ancestors, finding a consummation in death that eludes Dido and Aeneas. But that consummation is only at the cost of their kingdoms and the triumph of universal peace, crafted by the grave and austere Octavian. Eros has no fixed abode in Rome. The severing of Edenic unity and companionship, the rational and sexual intimacy so celebrated by Milton in Paradise Lost, which Adam alluded to in his lecture, lies deep in Roman roots. To think through this problem of the lack of Eros in Rome and why that is, why it's such a threat to Roman identity, I'd like to start by looking at the image of the oak tree in Book 4 of the Aeneid. Now, we've seen oaken images in Shakespeare, especially in Coriolanus, right, who receives garlands of oak leaves for his military prowess. Volumnia tells us that her son comes the third time home with the oaken garland. In ancient Rome, the garland of oak leaves was a symbol of military victory. Laurel for poets, oak for soldiers. According to Plutarch, Coriolanus received an oak garland after defending the life of a fellow Roman citizen. The oak tree is sacred to Jove, the father of gods and the source of justice. Thus, the oak is an image of divine authority and military excellence, of piety and martiality, attributes deeply important to Roman identity. The oak also symbolizes strength. It is an image of constancia, that virtue that Dr. Virginia talked to us about on Monday, that firmness in honorable purpose. Romans are, or at least like to imagine themselves to be, as constant as oak trees. Or as Caesar says, I am constant as the northern star. Oak trees are able to endure elemental assaults. One of the Volsces declares that Coriolanus is the oak, not to be wind shaken. The strong oak tree buffeted by wind is a fitting image for the perpetually assaulted strength of Rome. Roman constancy is constantly tested by powerful and wild forces, both political and psychological. So let's look closely at Virgil's image of the oak in Book 4 of the Aeneid. So Virgil writes, "And just as when the north winds from the Alps, this way and that contend among themselves, to tear away an oak tree hale with age, the wind and tree cry, and the buffeted trunk showers high foliage to earth, but holds on bedrock. For the roots go down as far into the underworld as cresting boughs go up in heaven's air. Just so, this captain, buffeted by a gale of pleas, this way and that, dinned all the day long, felt their moving power in his great heart. And yet, his will stood fast. Tears fell in vain." This oak is no young sapling, but hale with age, full grown and strong. It has cosmic proportions, with roots going down into the underworld, as Aeneas will do in Book 6, and branches stretching up to heaven. Clearly, this is no ordinary oak tree. I think that it is an image not just of one man, but of Rome itself, of the cosmic dimensions of the great empire that Aeneas is fated to found. Rome has roots in the wisdom of the dead, born as it is from the ashes of Troy, and stretches up to heaven, part of Jupiter's grand plan. It contains the whole universal peace. Octavian, Lepidus, and Antony, as we are reminded frequently in that play, divide the world amongst themselves. And this massive oaken empire endures despite the weathering winds, whether from Volsce or Carthage. Now, more immediately, of course, in this scene, the oak tree is an image of Aeneas's stalwartness. He is the constant oak tree. And the trunk of this grand tree is assaulted by the north wind, and some leaves fall in response. But the tree itself stands firm. Aeneas' heart, in turn, is touched by Dido's pleas that he stay with her in Carthage, the wind that blows this way and that. But his roots and his will endures. This grand oak tree has a heart, is able to love, and yet demands the sacrifice of love for its own integrity. It can only remain itself by repelling outside forces. Duty-bound Aeneas feels for Dido and yet remains resolutely rooted to the founding of Rome. It's important, of course, that Aeneas does not have the coldness of Octavian, or at least of Shakespeare's Octavian, a man who seems never moved by passion. Aeneas fought down emotion in his heart. He can love, but fate demands that he transfer that love from Dido to Italy. He must have public pietas, not private eros. It's even more poignant, of course, for Aeneas because, by his own confession, his true desire is still for Troy. He tells Dido, "If fate permitted me to spend my days by my own lights and make the best of things according to my wishes, first of all, I should look after Troy and the loved relics left of my people." His love is oriented backwards. But it must be directed away from both Troy and Dido. But now it is the rich Italian land Apollo tells me I must make for, Italy, named by his oracles. And as if he's maybe trying to convince himself, there is my love, there is my country. For Virgil, Eros, especially feminine Eros, is a profound danger to the splendid oak and the divine redirection of Aeneas's patriotism. After all, it is Dido's pleas that he stay with her that are compared to the wind that moves this way and that. Her erotic desire for Aeneas leads to restless instability. An oak holds fast in one place, where windy Eros darts around, lacking constancia, that firmness and honorable purpose. And some 1,300 years after Virgil, Dante will associate erotic desire and wind, punishing his lustful lovers in a gale, right, of hurricane proportions. The wind of Eros leads lovers to abandon moral principles. Aeneas is not the only one torn between duty and love. Dido hesitates to encourage her love for Aeneas because of her duty to her dead husband, Sichaeus. Just as Aeneas loyally honors his dead father, Dido too honors her dead husband, at least before she meets Aeneas. But her sister Anna's, what I think is very sensible advice, to pursue her love for Aeneas, I think Anna's great, makes a lot of sense. But unfortunately, this very sensible, practical advice persuades Dido to pursue her love for Aeneas and set her free of scruple. Eros overrides ethics. Without Constantia, pietas cannot long survive. Virgil asks, "What good are shrines and vows to maddened lovers? The inward fire eats the soft marrow away, and the internal wounds bleed on in silence." Eros destroys shrines, sacred places, and vows, sacred words. It is ungovernable, and Rome is a place that must be governed, must have the deep and sturdy roots of the strong oak. Eros also leads to the neglect of political duty. Dido's towers remain half-built. Military training is abandoned. Fortifications are untended as she indulges herself in her love affair with Aeneas. And Aeneas sinks into a kind of stupor, donning Tyrian clothing, right? Perhaps anticipating Antony and Cleopatra's penchant for cross-dressing. Right. And even he is laying foundations for new towers and homes in Carthage, not in Rome. Aeneas is always doing this in the Aeneid. Everywhere he goes, he's like, "Yep, this is the place. Let's build." Poor guy, he just wants a home. Constantly driven, right? driven away from it. But here he is in Carthage, building homes. So when Mercury arrives, Aeneas actually wakes up. He has been in a kind of, as I said, a stupor, in a kind of drugged state. The sharp admonition and command from heaven had shaken him awake. Eros is also enclosed. During the divinely created storm, Aeneas and Dido retreat into a closed cave to indulge their passion. The cave is secluded and covered, with no deep roots or heaven-touching branches, even though primal Earth and divine Juno oversee this secret wedding. It does not take place out in the open or with any public endorsement. And Dido and Aeneas enter the cave to protect themselves from pouring rain and hail, retreating rather than enduring elemental assault. Eros turns the lovers inward rather than outward. Let Rome melt. Here is my space. Kingdoms are clay, Antony confesses to the queen of Egypt. Personal caves are opposed to political oaks. After all, from those severed spaces, lovers might think things like, 'tis paltry to be Caesar. Love may make the world seem little. Eros even seems to turn religion inward. In her fevered state, Dido engages in frantic sacrifices. And when the breasts are open, pours over organs living still for sign. She's searching desperately for some kind of sign to confirm her own personal desires. Right? Some kind of divine religious endorsement for the choices that she has made. Virgil cries out, "Alas, what darkened mind have soothsayers?" Throughout Book 4, Virgil characterizes Eros as a wound or inward fire. Dido is ill and burning in her madness. Eros perverts and destroys from within. And it blends the personal and the political. As Aeneas flees, Dido cries out, "Oh, my Tyrians, besiege with hate his progeny and all his race to come. Make this your offering to my dust. No love, no pact must be between our peoples." This curse is fulfilled much later in the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage. Personal abandonment leads to political enmity. When Cleopatra flies in fear, Antony follows after her and loses the Battle of Actium. Personal attachment clouds political judgment. Especially personal attachment to foreign women. Right? But for all the destructiveness of Eros, the wind like Dido is not villainized by Virgil, though her feminine frailty is a liability for Rome. Indeed, she is the victim, the cost of doing imperial business. Not the victim of malice, but in a way, the victim of the very attractiveness of Rome itself, or at least its potential as embodied in Aeneas. In a heartrending simile, Virgil describes Aeneas as the unwitting aggressor and Dido as the surprised prey. Unlucky Dido, burning in her madness, roamed through all the city like a doe, hit an arrow shot from far away by a shepherd hunting in the Cretan woods, hit by surprise, nor could the hunter see his flying steel had fixed itself in her. But though she runs for life through copse and glade, the fatal shaft clings to her side. Erotic Dido has no deep roots, but is roaming and burning through the city. I was especially struck by the fact that she is a doe, given Cassius's comment to Casca that Caesar would be no lion were not Roman, Roman's hinds. For both Shakespeare and Virgil, the female deer is an image of vulnerability and instability. Gazing at the body of Caesar, Antony draws on the same field of imagery, oh, the profound twist. He says, "Here wast thou bayed, brave heart. Here didst thou fall, and here thy hunters stand." Caesar, unlike the corrupted Roman people, or mad burning Dido, is a decidedly masculine deer, a brave stag, even in his fall. Now, in Virgil's simile, the doe is hit by surprise. She's not fleeing from perceived threat, but taken unawares. And the shepherd in the Cretan woods is oblivious that his shot hit her. After all, he is far away. Likewise, Aeneas is oblivious of the wounds that he has caused. He is an accidental hunter. Oak in Rome does not intend to wound, and yet its very grandeur awakens desire. There's something erotic about Aeneas, his heroism, his physical prowess. He tells really great stories that Dido wants to hear over and over and over again. Right? He's got a cute kid. Right? He's a whole package. Dido confides to Anna, "How princely, how courageous, what a soldier. I can believe him in the line of gods." The martial excellence of Rome awakens desire, but it struggles to incorporate the private exclusive claims of that desire into its identity. Rome cannot allow for a separate space for that desire to flourish. Think of the way Norfolk bursts into Elizabeth's room, right, in a movie that we watched yesterday, and pulls back the curtain surrounding her bed, the bed on which she and Robert have just consummated their love. Right, it's an invasion of the sacred private space. Just as the Queen of England cannot keep the state from her bedroom, Dido and Aeneas, in their small secret enclosed cave, have no place in a Rome that is rooted deep and stretches up. So is Rome then, with its antipathy toward Eros between the sexes, primarily a masculine enterprise? Is that manliness dependent, this is the second question, right, and is that manliness dependent on a freedom from Eros, which at least in the Roman imagination can turn tyrannical? As Livy tells it, the Roman Republic is born out of violent rape. Sextus Tarquinius' erotic desire for Lucretia and her subsequent suicide lead to the fall of the Tarquins. There seems to be a connection in the Roman self-understanding between Eros and tyranny, right? And a connection between rational composure and republican virtue. The tyrant has burning erotic desire for woman. The citizen does not. In answer to Cleopatra's question about who is to blame for Antony's loss at the Battle of Actium, Enobarbus tells her, "Antony only that would make his will lord of his reason." Right? And in following Cleopatra, at least according to Enobarbus, Antony has committed the classical sin, right, of turning the soul into a state of tyranny. Right? It is a state of tyranny because will has usurped reason. Reason, that lawful monarch of the soul. And Roman virtue is there, too, manliness. Remember Cassius's concern about the effeminate spirit of his fellow Romans. "For Romans now have thews and limbs like to their ancestors, but woe the while, our fathers' minds are dead, and we are governed with our mother's spirits. Our yoke and sufferance shows us womanish." To be masculine is to stand firm, to resist, to be feminine is to submit and to be yoked. So the moral decline of Rome is marked by a movement from the father to the mother. And this antipathy towards the feminine is not just part of the Roman Republic. In the Aeneid, women are constantly attempting to thwart Rome's imperial destiny. See Venus and Juno. "Woman's a thing forever fitful and forever changing," Mercury tells Aeneas. "Women are fitful like the wind, forever this way and that." Enobarbus speaks of Cleopatra's winds and waters, sighs and tears, storms and tempests. "Women lack the rooted constancy of men. They are the changing wind to the constant oak." Now, at this point, you might be wondering, what of Volumnia? As one does. She has something of the oak in her. But that constancy comes because she places the masculine world of honor and violence above the erotic consumption, consummation, but also consumption. that was a Shakespearean pun there. He would appreciate it. The consummation between the sexes. She tells Virgilia, "If my son were my husband, I should freelier rejoice in that absence wherein he won honor than the embracements of bed where he would show most love." Public honor over private embracements. Now, to be fair, Rome's Eros problem is not an opposition to marriage, just marriage to interesting, passionate, bewitching women who command consuming self-surrender. We only read book 4 of the Aeneid, but if you know the end of the story, you'll know that Aeneas ends up with Lavinia, who is only a slightly less interesting version of Octavia, who shows a body rather than a life, a statue than a breather. Yeah, there's a woman. Marriage in Rome is to cold women, not magnificent burning Dido or Cleopatra, whom age cannot wither nor custom stale. Both Dido and Cleopatra have a grandeur about them as opposed to conventional Roman femininity. Dido carries a quiver sheathed in gold, her hair tied up in gold, and a brooch of gold pinning her scarlet dress. Gold and red, colors of Eros. And when Antony first meets Cleopatra, she is in a barge of gold lying in a pavilion woven with golden thread. Erotic love for golden women is opposed to the coldness of Rome. Coriolanus praises Valeria for being chaste as the icicle. And Lucretia, the paradigm of Roman femininity, is weaving while the other women are dancing and disporting. And again, to be fair, men can love these cold and weaving women, but never more than country. Roman men must subordinate erotic desire for the wives to their love for country. Cominius declares, "I do love my country's good with respect more tender, more holy, and profound than mine own life. My dear wife's estimate, her womb's increase, and treasure of my loins." Passionate surrender to a beautiful woman is always subordinate to passionate surrender to country. Now, I think that both Virgil and Shakespeare keenly perceive the danger of this subordination of passion for golden women. Dido, leveling accusations against her erstwhile lover, cries out, "Some rough Caucasian cliff begot you on flint." Coriolanus is described as a rock, and Octavian has the coolness of marble, detached and dispassionate. The oak in Aeneas can let some leaves fall, but how can he avoid metamorphosizing into stone? In asking readers to pity Dido, Virgil offers Romans an education away from rockiness. He both raises concerns about the wind-like instability of the feminine, in contrast to the oak and masculine, and asks his audience to grieve over the death of Dido and the sacrifice of her grandeur to Rome's political success. In his Confessions, St. Augustine famously laments, "I was forced to weep for the death of Dido, who killed herself for love, while bearing dry-eyed my own pitiful state." Augustine is conflicted about his tears for Dido. He seemed to be distracting him from his spiritual grief. We, I think, need not be so conflicted. Virgil creates space in the poem to weep for the suffering of those who are the casual victims of Rome, and for the stifling of the personal. Aeneas meets Dido again in the underworld, where he gazed after her in tears, shaken by her ill fate and pitying her. So we see that the oak tree must always remain capable of shaking, capable of pity. Constantia, while leaving no room for the total surrender demanded by actual lived golden Eros, is not utter impassibility. But are we left only with tears? Certainly in the Aeneid, there is no bewitching union between male and female. And in the plays that we read together, the closest that Rome gets to erotic union between the sexes is the union of Antony and Cleopatra. Their love allows them to see the smallness of the Roman imperial project. But they do not resolve the problem of Eros so much as criticize the all-consuming and at times inhuman demands of the political from within the sphere of the erotic. Only in death can Cleopatra call Antony husband, and only in death can the couple surpass Aeneas and Dido. Death clarifies and strengthens their love, and for Antony, it becomes the object of erotic desire itself, as he goes to death like a bridegroom goes to bed. Antony and Cleopatra gesture to a love that goes beyond Rome. Yet they are in a tragedy and offer no integration of erotic love and political identity, no way to unite oak and wind. They cannot restore the love of Eden that was lost. But Shakespeare is not only a tragic poet, thank God. He is a comedian and a romancer. And it is in his final complete play, The Tempest, where he gives us the union of the erotic and the political. In his imaginative engagement with Rome, stretching across his career, Shakespeare does not leave us in the dark abyss of tragedy, but he takes the eternal city into the realm of comedy. The Tempest is an attempt to rewrite the tragic Aeneid into a Christian comedy in which love between masculine and feminine are restored to their Edenic harmony and can serve as the basis for a rejuvenated society. Shakespeare explicitly mentions Dido and Aeneas at the beginning of the play. Characters debate Dido's status as widow and whether she is from Tunis or Carthage. And Ferdinand and Miranda, the two young lovers of the play, share much in common with the Trojan prince and the Carthaginian queen. Ferdinand is the heir to the King of Naples. And, like Aeneas, he meets a beautiful woman in a strange land after surviving a shipwreck. Miranda and her father Prospero have, like Dido, fled their homeland, Milan, because of the treachery of a relative. Prospero, both protagonist and playwright, uses his mysterious powers of enchantment to bring about the love of the young couple, and through them, the unification of Italy. He orchestrates the first meeting of Ferdinand and Miranda, a moment rich with Edenic resonances. The young lovers meet outside the bonds of the civilized world, on an island full of music, and as if they are the first representatives of their sex. Neither is sure of the humanity of the other. Miranda asks, "What is it, a spirit?" and describes Ferdinand as a thing divine. And in turn, Ferdinand calls her goddess, and oh, you wonder. Their worshipful, erotic enchantment is mutual, unlike the unbalanced love between Dido and Aeneas. We know Aeneas loves Dido. She's way more into him than he is into her. And I would say even more balanced than the love between Milton's awestruck Adam and the more self-possessed Eve. Eros is no one-sided affair in The Tempest. In the sacred space of the island, removed from the demands of either masculine Eros of Republican Rome or the cool detachment of the empire, in a place in which the wind is full of song, masculine and the feminine encounter each other as the wondrous other. Prospero allows for all the ecstatic longing of Eros, that yearning that takes the soul outside of itself and orients it towards desire for another, the yearning to be united to the beloved. The young lovers are swept up in a wild wind of ecstasy through an encounter with the mutual beauty of the beloved, right? This worshipful experience goes both ways. And on the island, Ferdinand and Miranda are withdrawn from the world. But unlike Dido and Aeneas, they do not indulge their passionate desire for each other in a secret cave. Venus, the goddess who causes so much trouble for Dido, is specifically not part of the celebratory song and dance routine that Prospero arranges to celebrate the marriage. Juno is there, but no Venus. For Shakespeare, erotic longing for the beloved need not be the destructive burning eros of Venus, but may be folded into the stable bonds of marriage. In their love, Miranda and Ferdinand experience an eros transformed from burning madness to worshipful longing. In the exhilarating winds of passionate admiration and stable constancy of marital fidelity, they unite the oak and the wind. The union of Ferdinand and Miranda, a restaging of the union of Adam and Eve, and therefore of the masculine and the feminine, becomes the basis for the new Rome that Prospero is fashioning. Ferdinand, heir to Naples, and Miranda, daughter of the Duke of Milan, will, in their marriage, unite northern and southern Italy. Their marriage is political, but unlike the marriage between Antony and Octavia, has the love of the parties rather than the policy of that purpose. The Edenic harmony of the masculine and the feminine, grounded in worshipful eros rather than political expediency, is the basis for political rejuvenation. So through Prospero, Shakespeare rewrites the founding myth of Rome and of Europe, replacing the burning Carthaginian queen, abandoned by her duty-bound lover, with the blissful union of a new Adam and Eve. In Shakespeare's Christian retelling of Virgil, Eden replaces Carthage as the foundational myth for the relationship between the sexes. Ferdinand and Miranda surpass Dido and Aeneas not only in death as Antony and Cleopatra, but in life as they prepare to leave the island garden to go forth and subdue the earth. Just as Antony's excessive love intimates something of Christ's or asks to be transformed by Christ, I think that Dido's burning passion for Aeneas may intimate the Edenic recognition of bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. The worshipful embrace of the masculine and the feminine that together become the basis for any possibility of universal peace. In a glorious and deservedly famous speech, Prospero celebrates his own magical powers over nature. To the dread rattling thunder have I given fire, and rifted Jove's stout oak with his own bolt. Prospero, often taken as a figure for Shakespeare himself, is able to harness the very power of Jove and rend the oak with the god's thunderbolt. Shakespeare, too, has this divine-like power to rend Rome in tragic plays that raise questions about Roman identity. Was there ever a real Rome? And thereby the identity of all the cultures and religions that Rome has birthed. But Shakespeare also has the power of refounding the cosmically grand oak tree, not on bedrock, but in the garden, where mutual eros for the beauty of the beloved presents, not a threat to political order, but serves as the very foundation for it. Eros is consummated not in death, but in marriage. And marriage is the ultimate symbol of Christ's own eros for mankind, the longing of the divine bridegroom for his bride. In marriage, man and woman participate in that divine eros, showing forth its splendor to the world. At the end of The Tempest, Prospero abjures his rough magic and becomes not the all-powerful director of a love story that will make a new Italy, but a man living in the world. And we too, as we close the play, the poem, the epic, we leave the stage behind. Leave the golden realm of poetry for the world of duty. And yet we are better for it, as our souls in the encounter have become vulnerable to the wounds of Eros, both in tragedy and in comedy. Like Aeneas, bearing his father and his household gods, we carry with us both the tears and the ecstasy, both the memory of Carthage and the hope of Eden.
Unfortunately, there's no good way to bring you the seminars and the conversations of the week as we discussed how all this applies to Shakespeare's era, Elizabethan England, and to our own era in the United States, though perhaps you can recreate some of the discussion as you look at the plays and consider the lectures. You might even consider gathering some friends for your own school of Catholic thought. The good news is that from June 12 to 17, 2022, another group of adult learners will gather here in Lander for another Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Why not mark your calendar now and plan to join us? You'll find it stimulating, full of warm friendship and fellowship, and the beginning of a wonderful Wyoming vacation. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.